You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 330 of the Colombia Calling podcast. And you'll have noticed, for this week and the last 2 weeks, we've been having an Antioquia-themed show. I haven't been trying to do this. It's actually been completely by chance. First, we had Emma Louise Jay out there in rural Colombia, rural Antioquia, just talking about her isolation and quarantine all on her lonesome. She's incredibly popular with you listeners out there, so it was a great pleasure to have her back on the show. Do tune into that episode. Very articulate, witty, and quite amusing, but also profound at the same time. Then we had author Julianne Pacheco on the line from Norwich in the UK, but her new book, her latest novel, The Anthill, is set in a less salubrious part of Medellin. A great read, out now everywhere. Spanish edition is coming out shortly, if I'm not mistaken. And definitely something you should get your hands on, because for me, it's really a representation not only of the protagonist trying to find her identity in Medellin, but of the city of Medellin trying to find its own identity in this period, but let's say post-Escobarian period. But today, my very special guest is writer and author Jenny Erin Smith, and she's on the line from Medellin. And we're going to be talking about the early onset dementia or Alzheimer's, which afflicts a certain percentage of people starting in rural Antioquia, and now how this has moved on into the cities over generations. So a really interesting science and health-based story, but at the same time bringing in the social aspects that we need to consider when thinking about Medellin and thinking about why this is happening. So an incredibly interesting show in the pipeline for you today. Very proud of this show indeed, and of course Jenny speaks incredibly well about this, and her book will be coming out in 2022. At the moment, the working title is Valley of Forgetting. So you can keep your eye open for that. Of course, we will have her back on the show when the book is out, and we will talk further about this issue. But she's really on to something with this, and I know you're going to enjoy this episode. Next week, we hope to have either journalist Manuel Rueda on the show, or indeed author John McKendrick, talking about Scotland's failed attempt at colonizing the Darien Gap. So thank you again for listening, and don't go away. We'll be back in the second segment talking to Jenny Erin Smith about her book that she's working on at the very moment during quarantine in Medellin. So stay safe, stay inside, stay isolated, and do not turn off this podcast. Keep on listening. Thank you again. Bye-bye. And we're back. This is the final segment of Columbia Calling, episode 330. I'm radioing in here from Bogota in Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And my very special guest this week is on the line from Medellin. So we've had three episodes in a row coming in from Antioquia. Her name is Jenny Erin Smith. She's an author, writer, journalist, a bit of everything, though, but incredibly, incredibly interesting articles and incredibly interesting books out. She's the author of Stolen World, A Tale of Reptiles, Smugglers, and Skullduggery. It came out in 2011, and this sort of investigates the world of the illegal wildlife trade in between the 1960s and 1990s. And indeed, she's the author of Cocaine Cowgirl, The Outrageous Life and Mysterious Death of Griselda Blanco, who was kind of the queen pin of cocaine in Medellin. And she's working
on a book. Working title at the moment is Valley of Forgetting, and it's dealing with the sort of early onset of senile dementia or Alzheimer's within Antioquia. So I'm really happy to have and really honored to have Jenny on the show. Welcome on Columbia Calling, Jenny.
Good morning, Richard. Thank you.
You're most welcome. How's life right there in Medellin? Having read your most recent piece in the Times Literary Supplement, one would think that things are a little bit morose. The title was "Prayer Group of the Oligarchy." Tell us a little bit about what's going on in Medellin.
Well, as you know, we're in our third month of supposed lockdown, but the lockdown is getting less enforced by the day. So it's a strange situation in which life looks normal in certain places. The center of Medellin seems to be some sort of tolerance zone for COVID because none of the lockdown is being honored there. So you can go to certain areas of the city and feel like you're in a pre-COVID time. Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit more of a sense of desperation here. Much more vending in the streets. I think as people have turned to that, you know, people who might have had a small store or something have set up on a blanket. Things are feeling normal, but they're not normal. I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah, I think you're getting.
We've stopped asking ourselves when it's over, because I think it's not going to be over.
Yeah, I tend to have a bit of a pessimistic outlook at the moment on this, and I try and see the positives. I try and see this. I mean, as we're recording this, I think I'm on day 92 of quarantine.
You actually keep the days.
Oh, well, yeah. It's killing me because I've got a calendar up and I cross the days off as if I'm like Tom Hanks.
Probably not the
healthiest. You know, right. Yeah, on the Castaway movies or something. It's not healthy, but I need to keep looking forwards, I think. So I don't know. It's hard. And in where you're living, in your particular barrio, people are obeying the quarantine or they're out and about?
No. They're finding clever ways to avoid it. The bars have done this thing. I think having restaurant tables out is prohibited. So the bars are putting out chairs, right? So who needs a table? You have your beer in your hand, right? So you can enjoy your beer, and you're not a bar. So that's what's happening in my neighborhood. You have a lot of people who have turned the little shops into bars. I mean, on a good day, they'll do that too, but it's just become more extreme, and congregated, just even sometimes sitting on the street. So I think if anything, if this has taught me anything, it's that people are destined to congregate. We're desperate to congregate.
Yeah, definitely. And are people, if you're sitting on your chairs, let's say, drinking a beer, are people six plastic meters chairs apart?
Oh, hell no. Of course they're not. What is nice, though, I think, about Colombia is that the mask no one ever thought to politicize the issue of the mask, right? So I assume it's a strictly American pathology or phenomenon, whatever you want to call it. But it's here, compliance with a mask is very high in all walks of life. You know, the homeless guy has a mask on. I think it just never became a thing. I don't think it ever occurred to anyone to defy this or that there wasn't an inherent logic to it. Thank God. And I think really right now, the only thing that's going to save us in Colombia probably is masks. So I think it's the only visible compliance.
Yeah. We're all wearing them here. I mean, everyone in Bogota. I mean, I see some people sort of pulling it down when they're not around anyone.
But, right under their nose. Right,
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Even the recyclers and the homeless, the beggars, they're all in their masks. Yeah, definitely.
You know? And I don't know if it's because they feel more vulnerable to getting it, which they would be, or because it's the polite thing to do. I mean, here in Antioquia, politeness is key. Nobody wants to be perceived as impolite. And I think that's a strong social pressure. So if that's part of what's keeping cases relatively suppressed, I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, anyone trying to predict what's going to happen is just making a best guess right now. And we can look at other countries around us and so on, but numbers continue to increase and right. continue deaths, fatalities, the tragedies continue to increase. Not obviously at US or UK or wherever else standards.
Thankfully, no.
And yeah, I'd be offended if I were in the US and someone started shouting at me for wearing a mask. I mean, it's like, it's my choice, surely, and I'm protecting you. It's like, I'm helping that you don't get sick, but let's not
right.
get into that.
That's the unique psychosis in the United States right now. I can't even begin to parse it. So I mean, it's hard enough to parse the lesser psychoses of the Colombian experience. So yeah. I think I'll stick to that.
Yeah, definitely. But let's talk about this new book that will be coming out next year.
Well, I think it actually will be coming out in 2022. Okay. I think COVID has derailed me a little bit on the reporting okay. of the book. But go on.
Fine. It's derailed you. I think it's derailed everything. So
exactly.
And of course, you can't travel. You can't go out there and
right.
get further interviews.
Right. I can't get to the towns. Right.
So. Let's say, I mean, you sent me the link to there's a piece in Undark from 2019 and excellent piece, very science oriented, but excellent piece about what you are doing and what you are investigating and taking in this one family. Well, I'm sure you've interviewed many families, but this Piedad, and she's in a town called Girardota. Just give us an idea of this area. And again, we haven't said it yet, but what is happening there? What is happening to the people in this northern Antiochian town? Most of my listeners will have read something about this phenomenon, this health phenomenon, but tell us the full in-depth thing.
Right. So in Antioquia in the 80s, I'm going to go back a little bit to explain it properly, because in the 1980s, there was a young doctor working in the San Vicente Hospital here, which is the main public hospital in Medellin, who began noticing cases of farmers in Antioquia who were losing their memory at, you know, in their 40s. So the first case occurred in 1984. And it wasn't the first case, of course. The cases have been occurring for quite some time. But the first case was registered in 1984. And this was extremely curious to these young residents working at the San Vicente Hospital, why such a young man should be losing his memory. And they didn't know whether it was Alzheimer's, syphilis, what it was. And they tested him for everything. And his name, well, I actually can't say his name. I have to change their names. But I'm calling him Mr. Palacio, Pedro Julio Palacio in the book. That's what his name will be. And the Palacio case stood alone for quite some time, because the doctors involved had to flee the country after 1987 when there was a massacre at the University of Antioquia. This was a paramilitary incursion in the university, and a number of doctors were targeted as having communist sympathies. So there was a rupture in an ongoing study of people who were losing their memory, who were coming in from towns in the north of Antioquia, and fincas more than anything, isolated fincas, farms. So later on in the early 90s, the doctors were able to sort of return and regroup in Antioquia, and they started seeing much more cases in Medellin. And what had happened between the 80s and the 90s was, you know, a lot of people migrated to Medellin. So diseases that might have been isolated to these little towns in the north of Antioquia were coming into the city. And so they were able for the first time to see whole families with this disease. And they didn't know how the families were related, but they suspected that they were related because they shared a few last names.
Yeah.
So there was the idea that even if we can't show how they're related now and we're doing their genealogy, they may have been related in the past. And they realized fairly quickly that, you know, these families were, you know, like I would say, like probably most people here, but these were old families that went back in these towns at least a couple hundred years, and possibly as much as 300 or 400 years. So there was a sense that this was a genetic disease, an inheritance. It was affecting, you know, so if your dad had it, you had a 50% chance of getting it. It had that pattern of transmission, which is called autosomal dominant transmission. And that it was likely caused by a gene. They had no idea what gene. Genes for Alzheimer's had yet to be discovered anywhere in the world, or were just being discovered then. So there was this idea in Colombia at that time that, you know, they were onto something big, because the family turned out to be really big, and they started discovering, you know, branches in other towns. And so by the early 90s, they had the idea that this affected some 3,000 people, right? When it's actually turned out to affect 6,000 people. Mm. Or there are 6,000 members of these affected families in towns, mostly concentrated in northern Antioquia. So Yarumal, if you're familiar with that town, which is sort of a rural hub in northern Antioquia, a town called Angostura, which is the home of Padre Marianito, the miracle priest, who's held in such high esteem. And all these little towns, and the towns had a few things in common. They were all farming towns. They were very old. They're very Catholic and traditional. And people had enormous families, you know, which is part of the reason that this family got so big. But just to put it in context, the reason this family is so important is because while all over the world there are families with early onset Alzheimer's disease that have been very important to science to try and unpack, you know, the genetics of the disease and how the disease expresses itself in the body and that sort of thing, you know, until this family was discovered, those families were like, the biggest one had like 110 members. So the Colombian family is on an order of magnitude greater, bigger than any other early Alzheimer's family in the world. And that means that the type of science that can come out of this family is almost, I mean, the sky's sort of the limit, right? Yeah. And so that's why it's become very important. And then in recent years, not to go on and on, but in recent years, this family has been of interest to pharmaceutical companies. You knew that was coming, right?
Yeah, of course.
It's been of interest to pharmaceutical companies because you have this enormously large population with a genetic mutation that causes Alzheimer's at a predictable age. Wow. So if they know when Alzheimer's is going to strike a person, you know, the question is, can we intervene before that? Can we prevent it with a drug or a vaccine of some sort? So that's been the question that's being explored here. But there's a lot of things going on with this family, a lot.
And
interestingly enough, it wasn't just the one mutation. As it turns out, Colombia is full of genetic mutations that cause early onset Alzheimer's disease, and no one knows why. Although there are some theories, but
what? I mean, we talk about this. Okay, so you know, this first family, this huge family, mm-hmm. and Pleister families tend to be huge, and of course, mm-hmm. but this first family. So this is then the Pleister gene, as people sort of call it.
Right, the Pleister mutation. It's called the genetic mutation. Right,
the Pleister mutation, and mm-hmm. you know, having read your piece, this is a presenilin one.
There we go. Is a gene on chromosome 14 that was, you know, in the 90s was linked to early onset Alzheimer's, and most people who get early onset Alzheimer's have a mutation on that gene.
But as you are suggesting now, that there's, you're saying there's a different onset. We've got a melting pot for early onset Alzheimer's in Antioquia.
Yeah, it's really weird. Yeah, it's not just Antioquia, but all of Colombia.
All of Colombia. So the conditions are perfect for this affectation. So what can we attribute to these two? I mean, you've done your investigation. What are our best guesses on this?
Well, it's right now it's pure speculation. So there's some really interesting ideas as to why this is happening. So you have this cluster of towns with the famous early Alzheimer's causing mutation, which is called the Paisa mutation. Mm. Then there are other mutations. There's one in Monteria. Mm. There have been some in Pasto. The idea for many years was that this was the product of European explorers coming with these genes already, right? That they're not necessarily explorers, not necessarily conquistadors, but European migrants in the colonial period were coming, and there was almost like, you know, I'm not sure how much everybody knows about the history of Antioquia or how Antiochians see themselves. But they've somewhat notoriously see themselves as white Europeans, you know, more than they are genetically, right? So the idea that the Pisa mutation came from a European settler was something was proven genetically, but also was something of a perverse point of pride here. We have these mutations because we're so European. So then in just very recent years, they've discovered 11 mutations in total. And some of these seem to be occurring on non-European genetic backgrounds, which means they were either indigenous in origin or African in origin. So the mutations can come from anywhere. They do seem to be coming in some cases from outside Colombia, but they've been established here quite a while. There's no question. And then there's the more esoteric genetic question, which is, what's keeping them in the population? Why are they persisting? And there's some ideas about that there may be actually some sort of natural selection, or has been in the past, that has caused these mutations to flourish and maintain themselves. And you know, it's interesting because all of the mutations cause disease after the age of four. Most of them. Sorry, there are some that hit you in your 30s. There's one in Cali that hits people in their 30s, which is really sad. But they hit people generally in their 40s, when here in this society, the vast majority of people have already had their children, right? So, you know, the question was, obviously this mutation costs you dearly after your 40s, but does it confer some benefit to you, these mutations, do they confer some benefit to you before your 40s? And there's been a lot of theories, but nothing proven. Theories that, for example, maybe it helped. They helped protect against some sort of infectious disease, or, you know, or there's a reason, there's a selective reason that they're being sustained in the population to the degree that they are. So that's all right now. It's all theory. I mean, there's a group at the University of California, Santa Barbara, which is headed by a young woman, not headed, but she's sort of running this specific project. That's looking at this question.
This is, I mean, the whole, you know, I am no scientist at all, that the whole idea that this mutation in this gene could have protected and helped people prior to their 40s, you know, let's say something as weird as, I don't know, leprosy or something, you know, it's that's fascinating to me. That's a completely out of the park idea for me. I don't think about these things. I don't know these things. That would be totally incredible to find some connection to, let's say, you know, your organism protecting you to then later fail.
Deal it to you. Right. Exactly. And so that's the question. I mean, I don't know that this question will be solved before I finish this book. I would love to have some answers to that. And there's certainly, you know, a team very interested in that question. I mean, you can think about it. If you think about it, most people, I don't know that whatever, if there was any protection that this mutation conferred people, I don't know that it would be so relevant to modern life, but it might have been relevant to colonial life, you know,
definitely.
It protected you against, you know, a miserable sort of pathogen or, you know, sure.
When we talk about the conquistadors coming over, because I remember reading that the Paisas were very, very proud of being maybe from the Basque area and so on. Is that true? I mean,
No, Richard, it's not true.
Okay.
So there's a million myths that Paisas believe about themselves. And unfortunately, a number of them over the years, and this, my book will deal with this, and I don't know how important this will be to the average reader, but it's interesting to me. There, a lot of those myths have actually made their way into science, right? So it's been held because there are many Basque-Lasque names in the Antiochian population. That therefore the Antiochian population must be Basque in origin. There's a pretty well-known Colombian historian, Enrique Serrano, who looked into this question and actually seemed to have found that those names were purchased. So they were likely purchased by converted or families of or descendants of converted Muslims and Jews who were living in Andalusia, Spain, or Extremadura, Spain, in the 17th century, And they were purchased prior to migrating to the Americas. And I'm not sure exactly what those last names did for people, but they must have legitimized them in some way.
Mm.
So at any rate, it's highly unlikely that the Antiochian population is Basque in origin. But that is, if you read about this mutation and you read about the scientific research or even the scientific papers themselves, they often say that the population is Basque in origin. Mm. So little myths that the Antiochian population has believed about itself over has made its way into the science. And this was really problematic when, as it turned out, the Piesse mutation wasn't alone, and that there were many different genetic mutations causing Alzheimer's all throughout Colombia that were, you know, come from non-white origins, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a surprise. No one was looking for it.
Yeah.
And they found it very late. And so there was a family that is black living in Hirodota that has a separate mutation, completely unknown for years and years. I think because, you know, there was so much attention being focused on the Piesse mutation that the existence of a black family with an Alzheimer's producing mutation was sort of overlooked. But as it turns out, they have their own very important disease causing mutation. So the history gets mixed with the science in a lot of ways and can have an effect on science.
And that's the family with Piedad in Girardota. And yeah, of course, you know, by doing this investigation and by, you know, making the scientific papers digestible, because you're putting them into in English I can understand,
right.
you're going into something that obviously is, you know, very present through all of Colombia and most of Latin America, is this caste system. And of course you're translating from the science to say, listen, you guys here in Antioquia and elsewhere, there are other people here, you know, who are,
and they've been here all along.
Yes. so you know, you might end up being at the, you know, on the negative end of some comments there, especially from Antioqueños, who, as you said, and the quote in your piece in Undark was, you know, a hidden story of blackness in a region that long ago decided it was white. And this is being debunked completely. I mean, this gene, you know, differing genes have come from all over the world. And you've now got this, I don't even want to say perfect storm, but this is, again, it's all there. And again, it's suggested in your piece as well that, it, you know, and you've mentioned it too, there's a family in Monteria, but Monteria for me in Cordoba and Antioquia, very, you know, the flow is very similar there.
Sure.
For me.
Yeah.
But then Pasto, which is, you know, far more indigenous, you know, really looking like it represents Ecuador more than Colombia.
Yes.
Are we in a situation where these types of mutations can take place throughout all of Latin America then, with this different slave, let's say, Jewish, European heritage? Yep. It's all over the place.
Yeah. So you're getting at something very interesting, which is, you know, what gave rise to all these mutations? Was it simply something brought over from Europe in the case of colonizers? Or was this the result of a sort of genetic clash of civilizations? That's that very little has been written about.
Okay.
And did it increase the frequency of these mutations? So you have, you know, for the first time during the colonial period of Colombian society, for example, you have black populations from Africa. You have native indigenous populations, which are, you know, it's pretty varied genome to begin with. And then you have these European populations coming over. And what happened genetically to, did that increase the frequency of those mutations? And you know, there are some people that that speculate that it might have, but this is really all very much in its infancy. But all across Latin America, these mutations are being discovered. So what happened in Colombia and Antioquia is that early on in the 80s, they identified this important family, a white family, a white Paisa family that's like a typical, almost postcard Paisa family, you know, living in fincas in these, you know, misty mountains with this terrible form of early onset Alzheimer's disease. That seemed to ratify this idea that, you know, this disease is European. It comes with the Europeans. We're European. But then lots of other people, you know, obviously have shown up since with similar diseases on different ethnic backgrounds. It's really interesting. And when you mentioned Jewishness, this is something very interesting too.
Yeah.
The genetic studies that were done in the 90s at the University of Antioquia, in part to try and suss out a little bit more of the origins of the Antiochian people, you know, in part because of the discovery of this mutation, they found a pretty substantial Jewish contribution, so a Sephardic Jewish contribution. So something like 15% of the genome of Antioquia, you could say, has a Sephardic Jewish contribution. That was a huge surprise to people, and it sort of ratified, really, I think it was an old slander about the Antiochians that they're Jews, they're good at business, you know, they're shrewd, they're, you know, so it was something that I thought was a slander, and a lot of historians had treated as a slander, but actually turned out to have some basis in reality, and that they found that similar proportion of the genome to be the case in Mexico as well. So clearly these mutations can't be completely unique to Colombia. The question is, you know, did the geography of Colombia, did the way people formed their early societies here help maintain these diseases in little pockets? And I think probably it did.
Yeah, you've got the early days, like you say, these pockets, these valleys where people didn't cross the valley. You farmed, you lived, you had children, you died, and then the next generation, very little migration, and then you get, let's say, you get into that post-colonial thing and the Republican period and the Thousand Day War and then the conflict. The flow is still, you know, marginal. Aside from the displacement to the cities because of the violence. So that's truly fascinating. So the Colombian situation really, really gives you a unique standpoint as a scientist.
Right. I would think, because so the question, the tension in all this is, were Colombians really isolated? Were Antiochians really genetically isolated? When the Paisa mutation was discovered and discovered in the 90s, and then shortly thereafter, there was all this work by geneticists at the University of Antioquia, you know, on the population of Antioquia, right? And I think the discovery of the Paisa mutation gave rise to an idea that Antioquia was what was called a genetic isolate, which is not a term that commonly used in, you know, to describe humans in genetics, but rather more plants than animals. But at any rate, that it was a genetic isolate, that it was like the Finns or Ashkenazi Jews, and that, you know, you would have certain diseases that were limited to that population because the population had been historically cut off from other populations. It's an interesting idea. And, but I guess the question is, was it inherently sort of nationalistic to proclaim that Antioquia, you know, a population of how many people, right? I mean, millions of people, including people of African heritage and indigenous heritage, would somehow be genetically unique enough to have their own, you know, diseases. It almost struck me as like a historical conceit. And I think it struck some, I know it struck some historians as a historical conceit as well, that it didn't necessarily hold up, but it was absolutely believed and promoted, in scientific papers for a good 10 years. So the culture gets into the science.
It definitely does.
And now I think,
I suppose if you tell the myth, you know, it's like that, you tell a lie enough times, you start to believe it yourself.
But getting back to the issue of Jewish heritage, something very interesting here. So when that 15% contribution of Sephardic Jewish ancestry was discovered and published, it was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, you probably do, but there is a community of Jewish converts in Medellin. It would be an interesting bit of journalism. There's been some journalism done on them. It was basically an evangelical Christian group whose pastor, after I think a trip to Israel or something, decided that they was going to convert the entire congregation to Judaism, and did. Right. Yeah. And not everybody went along with it, but certainly a sufficient number did. And so they're in Bejo in the north of Medellin, and they are practicing conservative Jews of some stripe or another. Mm. The discovery of Sephardic Jewish ancestry here in Medellin sort of ratified their claim to that, you know, and I think the scientists at the University of Antioquia were happy to sort of encourage them in their move to reclaim what was originally theirs, right? So not that any paisa could claim Sephardic Jewish heritage, probably, but that was, they had no more of it than anyone else in this region, but that was given to them as a sort of, hey, you know, you really have the right to claim a genetic Jewish history. It's really interesting.
It's fascinating because I am not Jewish at all, but I am fascinated by the migrations here. And there's a book that came out, was it the year before last, by Enrique Martinez, and it's published through the Universidad Javeriana, and it's called Quinta Sion. And it's about the Jewish migrations to Bogota and around. And it's the most in-depth and just phenomenal insight into, you know, we have here in Bogota, there is a Jewish community, small, but incredibly powerful. And he goes through each generation of that, where if they're Ashkenazi, Sephardic, and so on, and the ones who came via London, you know, back in the Republican era, came through the banks, the Rothschilds. I mean, it's at, and you can then, and he puts a family tree in, and you can see who they are today. You know, it's not about I know Enrique Martinez personally, and his English is almost good enough to come on the show. We're talking about it because it's quite in depth, but what a story. He grew up, his mother, he's from you know, humble origins, as they say here. He grew up in Facatativa, a town outside of Bogota, and his mother was the cleaning lady and cook for a Jewish family. And so he grew up in that family and celebrated, you know, Passover and the other Jewish, traditional Jewish celebrations with them. So while not Jewish, he grew up in that, and it became, you know, his obsession, and ended up doing his doctorate at the University of Tel Aviv. And that was the book.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating.
You definitely should read it.
I'm sure those Jews of Bogota would not look kindly on the pseudo Jews of Medellin.
No, definitely not.
Sure, they wouldn't, but I do think it's very,
But I had heard, and I think it was a Washington Post article many, many years ago, who suggested that it, not just the let's say the pseudo Jews of Bayou, there were families who never questioned why there were sort of the paintings alongside the lintels of their doors, and never questioned why they tied knots in the bases of their ruanas. And so it is that Jewish immigration from Andalusia, you know, from back in the Hispano-Arabic Spain.
Right. And there's a sense that then, and those people were probably probably didn't have entirely Jewish ancestry. And secondly, probably had spent generations already as converts by the time they made it to the Americas. But yeah, it's a fascinating occult history, like all of these histories. Yeah.
There's this in Santander as well, which I think in English, they're called crypto Jews. And in Spanish, I think they're called Judios Negros. Of course, they're not black, but it's just kind of the hidden Judaism. Because in Zapatoca, Santander, there used to be a synagogue, and the names in Santander, which are more Catholic sounding, are actually those people who purchased those names and changed their names. So when you've got like the Santa Real de la Campana de la Virgen, whatever. Those people are most likely from Jewish descent.
You know, that's fascinating.
I find it just so fascinating and so interesting that this is something that, because I mean, that that we have to, we tie this into the early onset of dementia and Alzheimer's and so on. There is so little knowledge of this more recent past in Colombia.
Right, almost by design, right?
Yeah, by design, and of course, everything has been, of course, erased by the conflict. We can't write anything here without conflict coming into it. But this other history that's right there, and this ends up being a lot of my studies for my dissertation at the moment about the industrialization of downtown Bogota, has just been erased. It's erased. These barriers, the history of them, the people who've lived there, the traditional communities, because all we think about, and of course there's a justification, the massive displacement of communities from elsewhere, how that's changed the economy and the society. But there are so many other things. And so I am thrilled that you're writing this book, and I will be first in line to buy it once it's out in 2022, but rush it if you can.
I hope so. Yeah, no, I'd absolutely, I would love to get this book finished. I want to tell you a little bit about something because the book is not just about the science. It's not just about the genetics. You know, it really is doing something a little bit than a reporter can do, even if you come in and spend 2 weeks, in this area with these families. The reason that I've been here for so long is so that I can follow the families themselves and what their experience is, and I've been very moved, especially by the young people in these families, because these are very traditional families. They are families that, if they live in Medellin, they haven't been in Medellin for very many generations, at most, usually one or two max. And so they are farming people who have become urban people, right, with urban ambitions and urban problems. So what this disease looked like in rural areas in the 1980s and 90s is a little bit different than it looks like now, where you have the average education in this family at the time that they were first discovered was, I think, 2 years, two grades of education. And now I think it's 8 grades of education. So it's not light years, right, difference, but it's a significant difference. So if you're a young person coming from a family with early onset Alzheimer's, and your mom and grandmother, died of it, but really didn't have much idea of it or what it was, or, they knew it was something that afflicted the family. Often it was said to be, some sort of witchcraft or a curse, which is something I've looked into a lot, specifically what type of witchcraft, what type of curse. And now you're, a young person going to university. How do you deal with this? Yeah. So that's what I've been really focused on is trying to tell the story of recent day Colombia, because these people have lived it all through them. But really kind of focusing on this next generation. And to be here a long time, I can see things that people can't see when they're here a short period of time. Yeah. I saw, for example, in this past year alone, 3 sisters die one after the other. It was a family of 12 kids. I mean, originally 12 kids. And, the sisters were in their 40s and I think early 50s. And to watch 3 die and be autopsied one after another was really... really something. And, and then to think about this next generation, whom I also know very well, and they're sort of aspirational. And how do you square this? How do you live with this? And, I think they're still kind of figuring that out.
That's something definitely very profound in that, to have been you're not even an observer because you're on the inside.
Oh, are you kidding? I'm so, I've so heard every line. Oh. That always happens when you're writing a book, you end up being very close with your subjects.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I really feel for them. I don't want them to get sick,
Of course.
I want this trial to work. I want something to work so badly.
Yeah. Oh, that's awful. I haven't been thinking about how this would affect you as well. Not, I mean, affect the family, the tragedy. But of course, this is on your doorstep. I mean, this is your, you live and breathe this book, and the family right. itself. This has got to be very hard.
Well, yeah, I feel for some of the young people that I follow. That, you know, I'm following people in all different stages. Some people are sick. Some people have died and been autopsied, and you know, their brains have been extracted for research. That is a program that they have going on, you know, in tandem with all this. They've been donating their brains since the 90s.
Yeah.
I have, you know, there's the clinical trial. So some of my subjects are being, you know, injected with experimental drugs or placebos.
Yeah.
You know, every couple weeks. You know, and I've, you know, I find it interesting to think about how they think about themselves, you know, and how much do they think about this mutation and whether it's going to affect them. And, you know, one thing they all have in common is, you know, right now, the way this study is set up, this long ongoing study at the University of Antioquia, they can't know if they have the mutation or not. Right. They can go find out on their own. There are ways to find out, but it's very costly.
Yeah.
And most people don't take it upon themselves to do it. And if they do, they tend to do it while they're abroad in, you know, in Spain or in the United States or something. And they have an easier time getting a test, but they haven't done that. So what's happening is you have a disease that for hundreds of years affected colonial farmers and, you know, latter-day farmers, you know, who are living almost like colonial people, right? And then only in the last 35 years, you have this rush of people to Medellin, into modern society, and they're living with the same disease. You know, I don't know that the farmer, you know, with 12 children would have needed or wanted to know whether he or she carried the gene. You know, who... You know, they would have been aware that there was a disease in the family, but they might not have wanted to know the specifics of how it operated or whether or not they were affected. But right now you have all these young people. Most of this large family is under 40 years old.
And they're urban and their aspirations.
I think they're largely urban. Yeah. At this point. Yeah.
And their aspirations are very different. And it's
right.
This is a real
legacy of the conquest of colonial Colombia, you know, and it seems grossly unfair, I have to say.
There's a book or two in this, Aaron, you know.
Oh,
that.
I think
you,
so.
Joni, yeah. You know this, so we'll have to have you back on once the book's out and have you discussing the reception and what's happened to the families of the protagonists in your book. I am truly interested.
You fall in love with them.
I'm kind of lost for words a little bit. You've really taken it and brought it into a very, very familiar, very personal level. And thank you. That's all I can really say is for sharing this with us. And I know that
happy to share.
And so the working title right now is Valley of Forgetting.
That's right. And I assume I've got probably about a third of the manuscript done.
Okay.
And we'll be working very hard in quarantine because all what's right. my excuse not to be?
Well, depression, I guess.
there you go.
Work hard, get back to the desk.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Much appreciated. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Check out Jenny's books, and they're all on Amazon and Goodreads and so on. I mentioned them earlier. Of course, we'll put them up on the Facebook page. We'll be promoting her book when it comes out. I will be reading it, and of course, 2022, hopefully 2021. This has been a fantastic conversation with Jenny Erin-Smith, author, writer, journalist. They're in Medellin. Really, really interesting. So a thank you for her. Follow her on Twitter. It's easy enough to find her. And of course, tune in next week. And as always, as I say, this time, stay safe, heed the warnings, isolate, and everything else. Don't get sick. You know, this is a tough time. But this has been Columbia Calling, episode 330, talking to Jenny Erin-Smith there in Medellin. I've been Richard McCall here in Bogota. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.